week, 365 days a year.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years. Pierre LaFon, Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines. CSU Channel Islands, no matter which of their academic programs you choose, you'll be at the center of your educational experience. And Sansum Clinic, whose multi-specialty team of medical professionals have been providing quality care to you and your family for 98 years. Actually, I've been saying that for a whole year. I assume now it's 99 years. So this is January, so I'm going to say that, that they have been providing quality care to you and your family for 99 years. And we look forward to their sponsorship, hopefully next year, and I can say 100 years. So today we have Leah Grippo with us, who's the founder and director and lead teacher of Wild Roots Forest School. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what is Wild Roots Forest School?
Wild Roots Forest School is a small preschool and kindergarten in Santa Barbara and in the Eastern Sierra in California that really immerses young children in the natural world, meaning we don't go indoors. We spend our entire school day in the woods. And our premise really is that human beings have an inherent right to have a relationship with the natural world, and that we've seen a loss of that. So our school is really dedicated to protecting childhood and nature having a bond, a close relationship.
There was a documentary on Norway a couple of months ago, and they have schools there that are very similar, where they don't go inside. The schools are out in the snow. And they find that it is, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but
I am.
But it's you know, we talk about nature. Nature is different depending on the climate.
Correct.
So when you talk about forest school, is that just because it was easy to use the word, or does nature include non-forest but outdoor activities?
That's a great question. Thank you. It's very true that nature, of course, includes areas that are not forested areas. And one of the challenges in the movement globally, and this is a global movement now, this model of education, is how do we name ourselves as a movement? And so there are a lot of names for it. Nature immersion preschools, nature-based preschools. And for us, we chose forest schools because we were spending time in forests, although oak forests.
So what is the age that you serve?
Mm-hmm. We serve 2.5 to 7-year-old children.
So from 2.5, to be devil's advocate, from 2.5 to 5, it seems looking from the outside, there's a lot of play that takes place. So I don't think that would interfere with some parents' desire for academic learning. But once you get past 5, there is, particularly today in some schools, some rigorous academics for, you know, 7-year-old, 8-year-olds. Is that something that you figure how to do, or you just don't bother doing it?
I think there's a third way. I think when you say we either don't bother doing it or we figure out a way to do it. For us, understanding early childhood extends from birth to 9 years old. We really take a developmental approach. And what is it that the developing child really needs at that age? So from 5 to 7 years old, we understand that the child's memory is just beginning to develop. So we do work with that. They begin to have free recall of memory for the first time, really. They don't need a trigger to remember something. They can go and reclaim a memory. And so we work with that as a cultural component of our school as opposed to a lesson plan component of our school. So, for instance, the teachers in our school from 2-year-olds all the way through tell stories from memory to the children every day. And we tell the same stories over and over again so that the children themselves memorize these old, long stories. We sing the same songs and recite poetry together over and over again. And so we're working with the development of the child, but we also recognize that young children, 5 to 7 years old, are being asked to do things. As the great Lillian Katz once said, we're asking children to do things earlier and earlier what they ought not be asked to do later. So we're asking these young children to, for instance, sit still for hours and hours on end, and their bodies aren't ready for it. They haven't moved enough to have acquired stillness. So with the preparation of the memory, the allowance for a tremendous amount of free movement and a great variety of movement, what we're really doing is preparing them to enter an academic arena and have the skills they need to thrive, instead of asking them to get those skills before the body itself is prepared to master them.
So do you, though, for a 7-year-old, teach any type of math?
Mm-hmm.
So is there, you know, straight academics taught differently,
sure.
But is there?
Sure. We work with mathematics in a really natural, real way, and pardon the pun, natural there. But there's always something to count. There's always a, for instance, every day we have tea time together, we always have to count how many people are there in order to pass out the right amount of napkins, and the children will do this.
Sesame Street did that 30 years ago. That's how they
that's
count.
Right. That's right. That's right. And these, and then there are concrete things. We're not working with abstractions with young children. Mm. We're really allowing them to see how mathematics live in the world. So, you know, even say, let's run to the third oak tree. We're really working with mathematics, but we're also working with one-to-one correspondence, which becomes a goal for education in early childhood. But it's really about working with what's already there, as opposed to creating something for the children that isn't related to their everyday experience.
Do you have a physical plant as well as going outdoors?
We do not.
So what do you do when it rains?
Thank you. That is actually, I think, the most common question that we get is, what do we do if it rains? First, I'll say we celebrate, especially here in Santa Barbara, where we tend to longingly wait for the rains. We provide all of the children in the Santa Barbara school with rain gear, quality rain gear, to wear for the year. And in our Bishop School in Eastern Sierra, because the climate is such that people already have that kind of gear, we don't need to provide it. So the children play in the rain, and we'll set up a tarp shelter for ducking under for meal times, for story time, for instance. And it's also a place to retreat if a child needs to retreat for some time, but they never go under there unless we're coming together for a meal.
So let me ask you a question my mother would have asked. Is there any difference in the number of colds that the kids get versus kids who go to a regular school? Do kids get sick because if it's cold out, because it's rainy out?
My experience is no, they don't get sick because it's cold and raining out. But we're also really protective of them, so we keep them warm. We make sure they're dressed warmly underneath. If they do get wet, we'll change their clothes. In general, my experience has been is that children who play outdoors in a natural setting tend to get sick less frequently than
That's what the experience in Norway was.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens at the other end? Now you have a child that has spent 5 years in this, you know, wonderful world of nature, and they graduate and they go to some Santa Barbara school, which is four walls.
Mm-hmm.
Is it tough to adjust?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a question that's actually very individual to each child, to be honest. I think there are some children who are going to find that a tough adjustment regardless. And other children, I find from what I hear from most parents, is they're thriving. They're doing really well. And I would say that there's probably a transition period for a few months where they are growing accustomed to a new structure and a new rhythm, if you will. But the other thing that I hear back from a lot of parents is that the time spent moving allows them to sit and attend when they are called to later, and that the time spent being social means that learning how to be social isn't taking up most of their time at school. So they have a lot more energy and attention freed up to what the school is offering them.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know when bullying starts, but bullying is a real problem today. But I guess in an environment like nature, whatever the age-appropriate beginning of bullying, I guess it would be less in that type of environment.
The truth is that stressors in general are decreased in a natural setting for all humans, not just for young children. But I think young children are particularly sensitive to that. So in answer to your question, yes, absolutely. Although I wouldn't ever call a young child a bully anyway. I'm kind of reluctant to put that label on younger children in general. But because there are fewer stressors on them, what we find is there's less conflict in general amongst the children.
How do the kids, is every day a different place?
Like, no.
So it's all, you all meet at some central outdoor place?
So our school is semi-nomadic. We meet in one location for a month at a time, and we have four locations that we would cycle through throughout a year. And the reason for that is there are several reasons. One reason is that we want the children to have intimacy with a place. So if we were going somewhere different every day, we wouldn't really be offering place-based education. We want them to notice the subtle changes from day to day in a place, and they do. We want them to know which individual birds inhabit a specific tree on a regular basis, and they do. But we also give the children a variety of terrain because our region really does have a lot of microclimates and a lot of variety in what kind of landscapes we have. And also, we're semi-nomadic because we also don't occupy a space for too long, and we give the space rest, and we don't overwhelm the community in any way by staying in one space for very long.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
With some health providers, you get the impression that the final goal is profit. But Sansum Clinic is a nonprofit. Their final goal is health.
Sansum Clinic was started by doctors and is still directed by doctors dedicated to offering the very best in healthcare and healing for our patients.
A nonprofit organization where all earnings go back into continually improving healthcare for our community.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansum Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Leah Grippo, the founder and director and lead teacher of Wild Roots Forest School, a school that, am I too old to attend?
No, come play.
Okay. This sounds like a good place to go to school as opposed to PS 187 in Manhattan, where I did go. So do you have any metrics as to how these kids do when they get to high school, when they get to college? Is there any, I don't know how long you've been, you're doing this 20 years? Or?
Yeah, I've been an early childhood educator for 30 years, and I've been running Wild Roots for 20 years.
So there must be some sense or statistics about how these kids do in the real world?
Sadly, I don't believe there are statistics about that, at least not that I'm aware of. Most of the research that so far has gone on this type of education has been really looking at measuring physical outcomes such as agility and balance and health and such. But otherwise, the movement itself, at least in North America, is really, really just now starting to grow.
Do kids come back, though? The kids come back and say, hi, remember me?
They sure do.
And they're happy and smiling.
They're happy and smiling. But I don't want to take credit for that because, you know, children really arrive who they are for the most part. And the best thing we can do is let them be who they are and not damage that.
So you talk about a movement.
Yes.
So this is not just you.
No.
In two places. This is a national movement?
Yes. And it's a global movement.
And what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I first started, I'll tell you this, I didn't know anybody else was doing this work. I didn't even know there were schools that had been doing this for decades in Scandinavian countries, in Northern Europe and Germany, for instance. And a few years ago, about 6-7 years ago, I realized, oh, there's a few other people doing this in California. I found three other schools. And now I think I've lost count, but I think we're probably in the 40s to 60s in terms of the number of schools just in half a decade in California alone, right? And this is happening internationally as well, and there's starting to be international and national conferences on nature-based education. And it is one of the most rapidly growing educational models for early childhood currently.
Which is interesting, which shows you, and I've been doing this show for 7 years about education, and this is the first exposure I certainly have had to this type of education. So mm-hmm. It's still in its nascent stages, obviously.
It certainly is.
You have a school in the Sierras. That's a tough commute. Thankfully,
I don't make that commute more than a couple of times a year. How did that happen? You want to know?
Yeah.
Well, I had a really remarkable teacher who worked with me here in Santa Barbara for many years who, due to an illness in the family, had to go back home to the Eastern Sierra where she was from to help caretake her family member. And it was just too much of a loss for the children to lose this person in the field. So we started another school where she was so she could go on, and that school is also thriving.
So the school is, I guess the movement means that people, it's not just a matter of getting a playbook. You really, as a teacher, need to really not only know the subject, but intuitively feel that this is the right thing to do. So it's almost like you need a certain type of person to be this teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And has to be knowledgeable not just in whatever academics you're teaching, but also what birds there are, what trees there are. So it's a pretty exhaustive list of requirements.
It's an unusual position in many ways. I also like to say that it's one of the only professions I know of where our job is to fall in love with people. And that is really our job, is to fall in love with children and their families. But yes, you have to understand early childhood and you have to be a naturalist as well. The reality is that the same skills that are required for observing and understanding children are the same skills that are required for observing and understanding the natural world and vice versa. And I will also tell you that the teachers that I work with, when they're having a stressful time in their lives, they'll often say to me, I don't want to take a day off, though, because this is where I come to rest.
Is this a not-for-profit?
No. We are a sole proprietorship organization, but many of the schools are not-profits. Yes. Well, we are a not-for-profit. But we are not a nonprofit.
Meaning that you have to make ends meet without donations.
Correct. That is correct.
Right.
Yes.
And that has to be difficult because it's an expensive community. It's one thing in the Eastern Sierras to run, I would imagine, a school without walls. But here, the teachers have to live in walls. And
that's
it's
correct.
Hard for any small business to be able to attract good people and have them be able to afford to live here.
That's very true. That's very true. It is, and it's true of early childhood education in general, that early childhood educators in general are really not treated with as much respect as we all deserve in the work that we're doing in terms of reciprocity, financial reciprocity. We really do our best to make sure that we're paying as much as we can to our staff, because if our teachers are not sticking with us a really long time, they're not having the time to really master what they do, and we want them to stay in the work that they love. So our model has always been to really be accessible and affordable to everyone who wants to have this model of education. So we never turn anyone away for lack of funds. But then at the top end, for those people for whom it might be easier to pay more, we do ask that of people.
And are the parents, and I guess it's tough to paint, you know, a homogeneous brush, but are the parents all, you know, the same worldview? I would assume the parents have to be environmentally astute, that have to be caring. You need to have the kind of person that has a view of life that is different from some people in order to put your child in this situation.
I would say that's fairly accurate. I think the community is probably less homogenous than you might imagine in some ways. I've had, for instance, parents come to me and say, my child loves to be in the mud and collect feathers, and I can't stand that stuff, so I have to send them to you because it scares me. And that takes tremendous courage, right? That takes tremendous courage on the part of a parent to say, that frightens me, but it's good for my child. Here's a good place for them. And then we have, you know, the other extreme of the spectrum of people who themselves are naturalists. Most people are falling in the middle of that space where they really want their children to have access to move freely, to play freely, and to be in a natural setting, in a natural environment. They're looking for the innocence of childhood that I think a lot of us are hoping our young children would have access to.
The changes that are taking place now. Early childhood, in my day, used to be 3 to 5. Now it's 0 to 5, because 0 to 2 is such an important part of people, of brain development. And so when we talk about salaries for preschool teachers, it's probably the most important adult activity that your child is ever going to experience in terms of the level of impact it's going to have on their future. So I don't think people realize how important, you know, they say, well, I'll put my kid in front of a TV set, which is probably the worst thing that you can do.
Yeah. Yeah. And early childhood, you know, because up until 5 years old, we live in a state where it's not easy to recall memories. Most of us have very few. We'll have a few select memories from before 5 years old, but few. And because of that, you have this kind of state of existence that is difficult for the conscious mind to recall later in life. And so it lives beneath the surface. And it's a tremendously important stage, even if you just look at it as this unconscious part of yourself that goes on living inside you later in life. But it's also a time of such incredibly tremendous growth of the body, of the brain, of the social being, of the spiritual being. It is of such vital importance that I find that children who have a really solid early childhood experience can go through tremendous struggles later in life and remain largely intact, largely healthy.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, and we'll be right back.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers, in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone?
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Sansom Clinic. We're there at the beginning.
And all the little and big steps along the way.
200 physicians for your every need.
A healthcare system where all profits go back into our community's health.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system. Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansom Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, Improving Attitudes, Creating Social Harmony, Bridging the Achievement Gap for Teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Leah Grippo, Wild Roots Forest School founder, director, and lead teacher. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from?
I was born in Soviet Latvia, in the Soviet times there. And
I just got back from Estonia.
Did you?
Yeah.
It's a lovely part of the world.
A depressing part of the world.
A depressing part of the
world.
Well,
you know, the people there were very verbal about how they have nothing.
Yes. Yes. Well, and that impacted my childhood as well, especially, I think, in Soviet times when, although even before Soviet times in Tsarist Russia as well, a lot of people had nothing.
Right.
And I think that was actually incredibly influential in my life, because what it meant for my family members was that they had to keep some nature connection intact, because there had been food shortages in everybody's lifetime. And we foraged, not because at the time I knew food shortage. I didn't experience that as a child, but because everybody knew that that information was important, that knowledge was important, and it was joyful. And I remember as a child, we would always go out into the woods together as a family to gather mushrooms, to gather greens, to gather berries, to go fishing. And we'd have our tiny apartment strung with herbs and mushrooms and fish drying out from the woods. And then when I was 6 years old, my family immigrated to California and have lived in California ever since that time.
So from adversity, you were obviously influenced by some of the good parts of that adversity.
Beautifully so,
yeah.
I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your first exposure to nature was through necessity, was through food.
That's right.
But why, and I happen to have an answer that I believe this to be true. When I go on vacation, I want to go to the mountains. Mm-hmm. We've done that for years and years, and go hiking in the mountains. So I sort of know that there's a truth here, but I want to know why. Why are trees and forests so important, and what do they teach us? Mm-hmm. I just have a good feeling when I'm there, but is there more to that? What is the is it spiritual? Is it something that the human being needs to have when they live in a city? What is the... What's the backstory?
It's a coming home. It's the place where we come from. It's the place that our ancestors have, for as far back as human history can reach, we have lived our lives out in the context of the natural world, in relationship with the natural world. So for many of us, it's a coming home. But it's also a coming home to self, because it's quieter. And that's not to say that there isn't a robust landscape of sound. There is. But most of the time, if you stay in one place long enough, the natural world around you will go back into a state of what is called baseline among some people, meaning normal activity, no disruption, everybody's at ease going about their daily lives. And I think we humans are very deeply affected by being immersed in that state of baseline, and we ourselves can then feel that again. However, I would say that I don't think that's a universal feeling anymore. I don't think everybody feels that way about being in nature. I think that if you don't grow up with nature as a safe and beautiful place to be, that oftentimes it can be feel very frightening to you as an adult or even as a child.
But can you learn it? I mean, we have so many people, because we have so many people in this country that either don't believe in climate change or trash. You know, I've gone on hikes and there's, you know, candy wrappers on the ground. I mean, it's just mind-boggling.
Certainly.
But so can you teach the reason we should respect the environment?
Certainly. You certainly can. The key word there that's an interesting one, though, is teach, because I don't think you can do that in a didactic form of teaching. I don't think you can ever tell somebody why they should love something and make them fall in love, or tell them why they should care or feel at ease and have that be effective. The key there is, I think, more relationship building. So time, curiosity, awe, gratitude, if those components can be there, then yes, absolutely. It's our birthright to be in relationship with the natural world. Yes, humans can learn that again.
What would you say that adults could do if they're listening to this and their kids are grown, but they're really interested in increasing their sense of the earth? And is there things that they can do?
Absolutely, there are things that they can do. And they're quite simple things, and you don't have to have access to the backcountry to get them. For instance, most of us, if we looked outside our window even, would see birds once we started to pay attention. And just becoming curious and not feeling that we need to know the names or all of the facts, but instead get to know a bird like you would a friend you were meeting, someone you were getting to know for the first time. It's allowing ourselves to be curious about the natural world. Sitting outside in the same spot, what's called a sit spot, on a regular basis, different times of day, different seasons, can connect you in wondrous ways that you can't imagine, and it's such a simple act.
Can I get a note from you? Because I spent a great deal of my time sitting in a chair in front of my house looking at a tree, and my kids and my wife think that I ought to get a life. So can I get a note?
I'd be happy to tell them that you're doing one of the most important things in life.
There was an interesting study that apparently blackbirds, what are they called?
Crows.
Are one of the smartest animals. And they did this study in Australia where they put a mask on somebody. I don't know if you saw this.
Yes.
And they scared the crow. And they kept doing it. And then they took the mask off, and they weren't afraid of the person anymore. Then the person put the mask back on, and they were all afraid. There's something about, you know, animals. Let's just skip away from trees for a moment. About animals that people don't appreciate. Mm-hmm. That there, I think, you know, again, I'm a dog lover, but there's more to animals than just simply obedience and beauty. There's something going on there that I think people who they appreciated it more, they would appreciate life more.
And I think it really just takes curiosity to be open the door to that appreciation and wonder. In fact, that study that you're citing, further studies have gone on to show that they teach their young, so for a few generations, that mask is scary. That's dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so their young, having never seen it before, see it for the first time and know themselves that that's a danger, right? There's a woman I greatly admire who likes to say that if humans had shiny black feathers and could fly, we probably still wouldn't be as smart as crows.
Well, you know, it's funny because I park my car every morning at the bird preserve when I run, and they just surround you. The birds are just absolutely not scared. The ducks are absolutely not scared because people feed the ducks. They have acclimated themselves to thinking that people are their friends. Mm-hmm. So there is a sort of, you know, they can feel danger and they also can feel.
Absolutely.
So speaking of danger, who taught you how to understand what mushroom is good and what mushroom will kill you?
Thank you. First, I just want to say that there are two kinds of mushroom hunters. There are bold mushroom hunters and there are old mushroom hunters, but there are no bold old mushroom hunters.
It's
deadly serious, actually. Yes, absolutely. And I don't actually teach children to mushroom hunt because of that.
Because they won't have the ability.
Because I can't trust that each individual child would have that ability, and it's much too great a risk for me to take personally. However, I teach my own children. My biological children are great mushroom hunters. Who taught me was my grandparents and my parents. That's who taught me. And my mother taught her grandson, my sons, to mushroom hunt, and he surpassed us all by the time he was 5 years old, so that he would run through the woods and say, there's one, and we'd walk behind him and pick up what he pointed out.
You know, it's amazing. We talk about, you know, life, and this has nothing to do with what you do, but I just was thinking that I did my 23andMe, and there's a possibility that my great-grandparents came from Latvia. Mm. So here we are in California, and you're from Latvia. I'm from New York, as you can tell from my accent.
Yes.
And yet there may have been a time when, like, I can just tell a good mushroom depending on the Italian restaurant I'm eating and what the pasta tastes like with the mushrooms in it. So whatever skills I may have gotten from my great-great-grandparents are long gone. But it's interesting about life that we could have, our great-grandparents may be hanging out in the same fields.
It's very possible.
Yeah.
Picking the same mushrooms.
Eating the same mushrooms. And those that didn't do it well weren't having
children. Didn't pass on their genes, that's right.
You're listening to HaHa Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
The Central Coast may seem laid back, but when it's time to work, no one works harder, including the bank that's grown up here. Montecito Bank and Trust offers customized lending and banking for all businesses, big and small. It's harder than offering one-size-fits-all solutions, but it's the right thing to do. And here, getting things right is a way of life. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
With some health providers, you get the impression that the final goal is profit. But Sansum Clinic is a nonprofit. Their final goal is health.
Sansum Clinic was started by doctors and is still directed by doctors dedicated to offering the very best in healthcare and healing for our patients.
A nonprofit organization where all earnings go back into continually improving healthcare for our community.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansum Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. CSU Channel Islands is affordable and financial aid is available with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, helping teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Leah Greppo, Wild Roots Forest School founder, director, and lead teacher. So let's talk about the specifics of the schools. You have a typical day. You've got free play, which is what schools have.
And, yes.
You know, if you drive by Montecito Union, you know, 9 o'clock, there's all these kids are running around in the yard. Is free play different in your environment than just playing soccer and walking and running around?
Sure. In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. The running around part is fairly universal. It's a pretty big need for young children to run, to climb, to jump. But I think the climbing and the jumping part is a little different. And the free play itself is quite different than it might be in other early childhood programs. So we can climb trees. We can jump off of boulders onto the ground. We can jump off of logs and jump over holes. And so the variety of kinds of movement that the children have access to is very different and constantly challenging. But in terms of play, so many traditional or mainstream preschools really focus on materials, toys, and learning materials. We have almost none of that. Our playthings are sticks and rocks and leaves, and hillsides and fallen logs and the like. So I'll give you an example. There's a fallen log in one of the parks that we're in, and it's on a slope, and it has its grand roots standing up towards the sky now instead of down in, under the earth. And the children like to climb up there. And the other day, they were up there, and they were on a rocket ship. And they were flying into outer space, and they were picking green grass and shoving it into a crevice into the log, and that was their fuel. And so what happens when we don't give them predefined playthings is they become incredibly imaginative, very creative in their play. And that kind of play is so much more satisfying. There's nothing to argue over. There's plenty of grass for everyone. There are plenty of sticks for everyone, although no one should never be surprised that everyone has their favorite stick and can track it even 3 days later in a pile of leaves. We'll be able to find their favorite stick again. But even that becomes really important because then we're looking at some really sophisticated pattern recognition that happens in the children's play so that we're not having, you know, identical triangles that you're trying to find. But the same tree will give 10 different shapes of leaf if you look closely.
So right? Whenever I see in a schoolyard kids in recess at 9 a.m., I always thought, what a waste. The kids are most apt to learn right in the morning. Mm. And it turns out that's not true. That is, sometimes the kids need to let off steam early on and then learn.
Yes.
So is that's something new, isn't it?
Well, I think it's something
new,
old.
New to me.
Actually, I think it's something quite old. I mean, in fact, we were talking earlier about how this is a nascent movement. But I think is actually really ancient, what we're doing. But if you think about the fact that most children these days are having to sit on their way to school, whether it be in a car, in a bus, however it is that they're getting there, most children are not walking to school anymore. And when they get there, they actually need to move. They have to move in order to settle the body, to calm the body, to focus the mind. So, it's very important to move.
So what's tracking?
Tracking. Oh, thank you. So tracking is really a form of literacy. It's a form of reading. It's a form of reading signs and symbols. And so when you, for instance, people who track animals read footprints. They see footprints, they see how deep it is, how fresh it is, how big it is, how much weight the animal put down on it, and it tells a story. You get a story of what happened here. And so tracking can be paying attention over a period of time to all manner of symbols. But we do track animals, and in many ways I think that tracking animals is one of the human's first kinds of reading. First methods of literacy, if you will.
And that gets us into storytelling, which is a really important part of a child growing up. It's stories and narrative tales, you know, help, I guess, children and adults to make sense of everything that seems to be random. Mm-hmm. And you are a storyteller.
I am.
So tell us what that means to be a storyteller.
Oh, well, that is a very big question, what it means to be a storyteller. What it means to me to be a storyteller is in many ways a very profound responsibility. Human beings, in my experience, actually learn everything best through story. It seems our brains are hardwired to learn through stories, and our ancestors knew this. And especially the brain of a young child, which thinks in images. A young child thinks in images. And I would say all of us do. For instance, if I said to you right now, don't think of a pink elephant, what's the first thing you see in your mind?
A green elephant. Oh,
fair enough, but the elephant's there. Right. We can't help but think in pictures. But if I say to you, don't run, what image do you see there?
Sadness.
Well, most children will see the image run. Right. Yeah. So we think in pictures. So if we're going to speak a child's language, we want to speak in stories and enrich metaphorical imagery. And so it's a great responsibility to be a storyteller because it means you keep and protect stories and share them. And sometimes there are stories that just want to be told and will scream at you to tell them if you can really listen and pay attention. In my experience, children, young children especially, but I've worked with teens who also are hungry for stories as well, even the old fairy tales. In my experience, we need stories like we need food and we need air and we need love.
So I was fairly successful in my Wall Street career, and people asked me what I attributed my success to, and no one could understand my answer. And I said I could tell stories, because and I didn't mean stories, fiction stories, but I try to make sense of things that weren't intuitive, where people could understand what seemed to be random. And I think there's a need for people to have some sort of order to learn. And I remember having really difficult time learning calculus. I had no idea what to do. I was flunking out of calculus. And then I got my master's, MBA, and they taught calculus as a story. They said, how do you use calculus? Well, if you're running a factory and your growth is growing at so much, we can use these equations to tell us the rate of growth. They attached an intuitive, real-world attribute to the mathematical abstract. And so I think that storytelling not only is fun, and it probably helps learning just because it keeps people's attention, but it really is an important part of how the human brain sucks things in.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you think about the brain structurally, you know, we have these two hemispheres, these two lobes, and of course they're constantly working together all the time. But they do have separate and distinct.
Yeah, I'm a Gemini.
Functions.
I understand that.
That's right. So they do have these separate and distinct functions as well. And storytelling makes us work back and forth constantly. And so we're retaining information because we're integrating this information throughout our mind with these pictures that it paints, as opposed to trying to use this one small discrete part of our minds, which so often we do when we're teaching abstract concepts abstractly.
And that's why games work too.
Absolutely.
Because games provide an ability to almost mask what really is going on. By playing a game, it takes a lot of the tension away from some of the bigger issues that you've been learning.
And all learning is state-based, as we know, right? So if you're anxious or nervous while you're learning something, that anxiety and nervousness will always be a part of the information that you hold in your mind about that topic. It will be part and parcel.
Is that why I'm so neurotic? Is that why I'm so nervous all the time? Doctor, can I lie
that,
down?
That may be ancestral.
you're listening to AHA Presents About Education, and believe it or not, we'll be right back with our final segment.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
What's that?
This? The newest online business banking around.
Can you initiate wires and approve transfers?
Yes.
Pay bills?
Check.
Cash management?
Of course.
All business, all online, all on your phone?
You bet. My computer, too. It's Montecito Bank and Trust's new business online banking. It works as hard as I do.
Huh. Montecito Bank and Trust.
You got it. Montecito Bank and Trust. Behind every great community is a great bank. Montecito.bank. Member FDIC.
Sansom Clinic. We're there at the beginning.
And all the little and big steps along the way.
200 physicians for your every need.
A healthcare system where all profits go back into our community's health.
Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system. Your health.
Your doctors.
Your healthcare system.
Sansom Clinic. Good for you.
Santa Barbara residents interested in a four-year degree have more than one choice. CSU Channel Islands is a four-year accredited university offering more than 30 academic programs that are interdisciplinary, multicultural, and centered on you, the student. Your professors are accessible mentors who go above and beyond to help you pursue an undergraduate or graduate degree or certificate to advance your career. Programs and workshops in classroom, online, with campuses in Thousand Oaks and Goleta. Call CSU Channel Islands at 805-437-8520 or online at csuci.edu.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. I'm Neil Chrysella. We're here today with Leah Grippo, Wild Roots Forest School founder, director, and lead teacher. Now, this is a little bit off subject, but because AHA deals with teens, is there a way to integrate this with teens that even though they're past your school, but can they benefit from going out into nature?
There isn't a single human being alive who can't benefit from going out into
nature.
Even
Richard, our engineer?
Even Richard can benefit from going out into nature.
He's not allowed to leave this building from 9 to 5, so it'd be tough for
him. Could at least give him a window with birds outside. But absolutely, teens absolutely need nature in... They're seeking, teens are so often seeking the edge experience. They're seeking to test their boundaries, to test their, if you will, overconfidence that they often have, right? And the natural world offers this in so many ways because there's always a challenge to be had in the natural world. The book of nature is never finished. You've never learned all there is to learn in the natural world. We'll never get there.
One of the things I ask many educators is how, if you can, teach empathy, because lack of empathy is really, I think, manifested itself in a way that has caused bullying. It's caused the discourse, politically dysfunctional discourse that we have. And the question is, how do you teach empathy? And I can't help but believe that learning about the world beyond urban living is a good way to teach empathy.
Can I tell you a story about that?
Yeah.
So once I was out in the woods with the children at school, and we were looking at a nest that had nestlings in it. We were so excited. We were pointing at it. We were calling one another over to look at it. It was so exciting to watch the parents come and feed the babies. But we were being watched. The crows were watching us. And so all our pointing pointed out to the crows where this nest was. And in front of our eyes, the crows came and took the nestlings and ate the babies. So now, knowing this, the children and I also, we felt terrible. We had been responsible for this. We had pointed out the location of this nest. So the next week, I'm wandering with the same group of children, and we hear baby birds begging, juvenile begging. It's a very distinct sound. And one of the little boys grabs my leg, and he starts yanking on my pants, and he says, Leah, stop. We can't go find it unless we know there are no crows around. And then the children look about to see if there are crows about. And sure enough, there are no crows about. So we go and we find these young juncos who are being fed by their parents. And we're watching them when the little boy starts pulling on my pants. We've got to go. There's crows. And immediately we left. And if that isn't empathy, I don't know what is. But it came from us making a terrible mistake, a terrible blunder, and then having an opportunity to learn from it and make it right because we cared. And if I had just told them crows eat baby birds, they may have never really understood what that meant.
And just to quickly pile on to that, every year juncos make a nest in my garage, and I have to leave the garage doors open because we don't want to lock the juncos in. And somebody said to me, why are you worried about juncos? They're just juncos. And so here you have these kids realizing that whatever life exists is really important. And just juncos doesn't really cut it.
No, it doesn't cut it. In fact, for us, the juncos are one of the birds that we have the most intimate relationship because when we sit down to eat, they come so close.
Well, thank you so much, Leah Garoppo, for everything that you do. I am so motivated now. Even though it's going to rain tomorrow, I'm going to go out into the rain and go into the woods.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for being here. Thank you for all you do. And thank you, everyone, for listening. You've been listening to AHA Presents About Education, and we'll see you next week.
It's